My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club. Where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their life. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. So I met this lady. I met that lady a few months ago at this retreat that we go to, which is awesome. She does a Big Book study on Wednesday nights that is just phenomenal, and I love it, and I love her energy, and so I give you Heather.
Hello, everyone. All right, I'm Heather, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey!
Thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Tim. I appreciate you. It's an honor to be speaking here tonight. Thank you to my sponsees and friends and family who are here tonight. Thank you, guys. Can't do this without you. It's all about a network. So let's get started on the journey of Heather. And I see you're Heather, too, so I like it. I like Heather's in the front row. I've been sober for 8 years. I got sober October 7th, 2013. I have a sponsor. Her name is Leslie Strange. Many of you may know her. She has 33 years in sobriety. She has a sponsor who has 37 years in sobriety. I come from a very strong lineage of women in sobriety. And I like to stick with the winners in the sense of people who have had experience in life and know how to walk through everything. And I love my sponsor for the fact that everything has a solution. You know, there's never a problem that can't be unpacked or have a solution to come with it. No matter how bad it is, no matter how great it is, there is always a solution. And so that's the lineage of women that I come with. And I know my sponsees know I probably come off pretty harsh sometimes, but there is always a solution, you know. And we have to stick to the facts. And that's something that I've had to learn over the years. But before we, you know, jump into the recovery stuff, I'll give a little background on me. I am originally from Los Angeles, California. Born and raised. Yes, my Los Angeles people over here. Yes, I love it. Bring it home. That's how you know this is a God shot. You know, the Los Angeles people are in the room. I love it. So, born and raised in Los Angeles. I essentially lived in the Beverly Hills, Brentwood area. So, yes, I am your classic, you know, just bougie kid. Yes, I went to private school, all that good stuff. You can't go to public school in Los Angeles. It is just not a thing. So I come from a great family. From the moment that my life started, I felt as though I had a struggle. I am mixed, black and white. My mom is white. My dad is black. So there was already, you know, this diversity coming in. And then from the moment that I can remember, and this is from looking back from doing these steps and walking through the program, but now that I look back on my story, I see that I was a pathological liar at the age of 4. So this all started even before drugs and alcohol come into my story. I remember being a small child and just always thinking of lies, you know, always thinking of a story, always needing to make the story better, you know, it just wasn't good enough the way it was. From exaggeration to everything else. And that's basically, I used to get in trouble for it a lot. My parents would just be like, why are you such a liar? You know, like you lie about the simplest things. And so then I turned it into, well, if I cry, I'm telling you the truth, you know? So then I started manipulating. So it gets more and more, you know? And this is like all from a very small child, age 4, I'm telling you. Like, and I have great parents, you know, and I lived, have a great family dynamic. Unfortunately, when I was 13, my dad did pass away from cancer. He struggled with it for a very long time, and it was one of those things where, you know, because you're walking through with a parent who is suffering from such an extreme disease that at the time, this is probably like 25 years ago, they didn't have a cure for it. They didn't know how to treat it. They didn't know what to do for cancer. He had a very rare type of skin cancer, and so So yes, we walked through that, and then he ended up passing away from that. And in that moment, you know, my whole family is falling apart. They're crying. They're devastated. So I determined that I needed to turn off my emotions. I needed to become strong. I needed to become hard as a rock in my heart. And I needed to toughen up. And so I never grieved about it, no matter how many, you know, therapy groups I was in, no matter how many therapists, psychiatrists, none of that. It was always this story that I would spin in therapy, of why I was doing okay, why things were all right, you know? And I never really got down to the truth of why I was so sad. And it's okay to be sad. I've learned that now. It's okay to mourn. It's okay to grieve. But I didn't know that at the time. And so that sets up my drive. And so I'm in the seventh grade, and I'm at a new private school now. And it's basically like, it was like a job. It was like a full-time job, 8 hours a day. You know, we carry all these books. You have a backpack full of shit. Like, you're doing all sorts of stuff. And so I literally, so would come home. My parents had a huge liquor case. And I would have a rum and Coke. Because I felt like at age 13, after a long day at work, you need a rum and Coke. So this is how I started. Age 13, I'm drinking after my long day at school, okay? And so... it just turned into a habit that I continuously did. And my mom never said anything. I think she was very, like, startled, like, don't push Heather. Like, we don't know what reaction we'll get, you know? And so so every day I'm coming home drinking my rum and Coke. I'm doing my homework. Sometimes I'm passing out from drinking my rum and Coke or having too many rum and Cokes, you know? Like, and so that's basically how high school went. And, you know, I was really, you know, I felt like I was a good person who used properly, you know, like you have your one drink in the evening once you're done doing your work, you know, I'm already planning this out in my mind. And then on the weekends you can let loose, you know. So as I got older, I started going to parties and hanging out with people and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And that's when it really, you know, took off, because I was the life of the party. I loved to have fun. I loved to laugh. I loved to be the center of attention. And I loved to call the shots. And I was full of ego and full of selfishness and all sorts of things, you know. But that was the life. And for those of you that haven't been to Los Angeles or haven't lived there, we kind of live in this box where Hollywood takes over everything, you know? So you almost feel like you're living this false reality type life where people are watching you, but it's very surreal in the sense of how you live there, and everyone is somebody. And that's how I lived, you know? And I rubbed shoulders with prominent friends, and my parents were friends with people, and so it was a lot growing up. Now my grades are going down a little bit, but I'm still at a top college private school, you know, and it's time for college. And I am devastated that I haven't gone into any schools in California, you know, because they're just like, no, you're not smart enough. And I was just like, what the fuck? And so I'm like, do you know what school I go to? And so they were just like, no, we think you need to spread your wings. So I ended up at the University of Arizona. And that is the party school of the nation next to Florida. I'm at Arizona. I'm a collegiate cheerleader. I'm a football cheerleader. So now I'm friends with the football team. I'm friends with the cheerleaders. This is the perfect sense of life for me. Athletes in college get everything you want. You really don't have to do a lot of studying or go to school or anything like that. You get to do your sport, support the school, bring something. I was part of Spirit, and then you party on the weekends or party after a huge game or something, you know, and it was great. And my drinking took off to a point where I'm drinking every single day now, and there are blackouts being involved. And you know, it's interesting because as I would come out of some of the blackouts, depression really started to hit me, and so some mental health things started coming in. And so I ended up, I did get, because I've had a psychiatrist my whole life that I've been lying to on and off. So so I get a new psychiatrist in Arizona. We start talking about some things, kind of talking. The biggest thing that was bringing up my depression was that I never mourned my dad and his passing away. And so I'm working through that, but I'm drinking the whole time. And I'm kind of just like creating this like reality that's not real, you know. And so it was a very interesting time because – I just didn't know who I was, you know? And alcohol made me that person. Alcohol made me not afraid of anything. It gave me strength. Alcohol allowed me to say whatever I wanted and not care, you know? Like, alcohol literally was liquid courage for me. And that was my thing over and over and over again. But then, you know, I ended up getting in a horrible cheerleading accident. We were stunting during a game, and they dropped me. And I hit the field pretty hard. And that started a huge, intense reality of concussions and blackouts and things like that. The only good that came out of it was I was prescribed some very heavily sedatives and other party favors. And so that kicked off that whole side of like, whoa, you can like numb yourself and be like totally just in another zone, you know? And I was like, this is amazing. Drinking doesn't ever get me to that point, you know? And so now I'm, you know, doing everything. And so I'm suffering from this concussion. I'm playing the victim. You know, I literally dragged that out to the T. Now the concussion was serious. Like being thrown up in a stunt and not being caught is very serious. And so, you know, I had to see neurologists and things like that, and I ended up moving back to Los Angeles. And, you know, some years passed, and my drinking just kept going up, you know. It was like, it was never anything that hindered or stopped or anything, no matter what. I ended up, you know, of course, there's always a guy. You meet a guy. I had many guys, but there was a particular guy that brought me out to Georgia, and that's how I ended up here. And so with that, you know, it's interesting to go back really quickly. Many of my friends who I drank with are now in AA. And so it's very interesting. I was with the right circle of people, but we were definitely addicts and alcoholics. And so I remember the first time I did get in trouble for drinking, in the sense of my friend and I, my very good friend, childhood friend, we ended up blacking out, getting very drunk, and it was right around the holidays. I didn't exactly realize that that occurred on Christmas Eve, so I never showed up for Christmas. Neither one of us did. And it wasn't until like 3 days after Christmas that anyone found us, and we were in her apartment just drinking bottles and bottles of Jack Daniels. And so immediately they were like, her mom was very adamant, you guys are going to treatment. You have a problem. And so my first taste of treatment and this program was very... It was a very wonderful and surreal experience. I went to a beautiful rehab in California where it was on the beach, and we did yoga, and we wore robes, and we had a nutritionalist, and we talked about amazing things and being spiritual and, you know, really just like, oh, don't worry. This is just something you've gone through in your life, but we're going to uplift you, and as long as you practice yoga and these spiritual things, you will be okay. And I was like, oh, my gosh, this is awesome. And so then, of course, on the last day when it was time to leave, and I didn't want to leave because I'm like, this place is awesome. Like, you know, they were like, and we suggest you go to an AA meeting, and they gave me this book. And so I thought the book was just like this pass to get into the meetings, you know, and get friends and stuff. And so I would just carry my book around, and I'd be like, I got the AA book, where's the meeting? You know, like top secret, I got my book, you know? And they'd be like, oh, just go over there and sit down. And I'd be like, oh, okay, great. And so, but I never opened the book. I didn't know what the book said. I didn't know a thing about Bill Wilson. I didn't know anything. I didn't even know what this book was. Like, and so I just carried it around, and it was crazy. And the meetings that I went to in Los Angeles, they weren't book studies or anything like that. No one ever talked about the book. Like, we always had open discussion and just talked about like not drinking, you know? And so, so that was my first taste of AA. I would say that it was very positive, in the sense I loved the fellowship and I loved the people. All of the people got me. I didn't have to explain what I was thinking. I didn't have to explain why. I didn't have to explain why I chose to do the things that I did. Everyone in the room knew, and they accepted it, and they were loving, and that was beautiful. But like I said, I did the geographical change a couple of times. I went from Las Vegas to Georgia and some other places, but I finally ended up in Georgia. And so that's when my drinking, you know, stopped being fun and now started becoming like really serious, in the sense that, you know, I didn't know anyone here. And so it's interesting because I brought myself with me, so the same thing started happening. And it's one of those things that I always say, like, you could put me anywhere and I would probably find the people that I hang with and the people that are like-minded like me. But I came to Atlanta and it was very lonely. And the people that I did start to hang with in the beginning, like if we went to clubs or anything, I outdrank them. And they couldn't hang with me, you know? Like, I was the last one standing. And so it wasn't fun to be with them because everyone already went home. So it kind of came down to the fact that I was like, I'm just going to drink at home. I'm going to drink in my closet. You know, like, I just want to be in four safe walls and drink by myself, because then I don't have to explain anything to anybody. And I don't have to tell you why I'm having another one. And I don't have to tell you the reason or the story or what happened today or yesterday or in my mind. I didn't have to do any of that. It was very peaceful, you know. It was that peaceful sense of I'm alone with this huge bottle and that's it, you know. And so, but through that, you know, I did end up getting married, and I've had some kids as well. I have two kids. I have a boy and a girl. They're really sweet. They are completely sober. They're good. So I did that right. You know, I at least got that right. But then, you know, my mental health really started picking up. It was untreated. I'm not on any meds for that. There's a lot going on, and the biggest thing that happened that got me into these rooms, you know, 8 years ago, is that I had, like, a literal public suicide mental breakdown. And so to share with you a little bit, my ex-husband and his mother, and you can already assume what that means together, ex-husband and mother, you know, like, so we go into the bank, and this is on Holcomb Bridge and Old Alabama, and right here in town. And it was like someone just triggered me, and I lost my shit, you guys. I lost my shit in that bank that day, and it was wild. I mean, you have never seen so many scared faces. I literally saw red, I saw black, I saw every color that you could possibly think of. But the only thing is that I didn't think to hurt anyone else. I only wanted to hurt myself, because I had a hole inside of myself, and I was mad at myself. I was mad that I got myself here. I was mad that I was in this situation, and for that, the only thing I could really think of, because in that moment, you would think that I would want to hurt someone else because I'm so angry. Instead, I wanted to hurt myself. I wanted it to be over. And so that moment of true suicide came out. I ran out into the middle of the street, and I see this huge semi-truck coming, and I'm like, thank you, God. You know, that moment of like, yes, I am going to end it in the middle of this road, and I will finally be free. I will finally have serenity. I will finally not have to struggle anymore. And surprisingly, there's, you know, police lights behind me and all this stuff, because I just had a whole episode in the bank. So they're stopping everybody in the traffic, and I'm like, why is the truck slowing down? It's not going as fast anymore. And all of a sudden, I just hear this guy, and he's like, miss, I need you to come with me. And I was just like, oh, God, you know. And so the police were there, Roswell police, very nice people. But this was that moment when it was real. It was no longer jumping in out of a fun treatment centers. It was no longer wearing your robe and doing yoga. This was real. I was now a warden of the state because I had just publicly attempted to commit suicide. I remember falling to my knees and praying to God. And it was the first time that I really felt it. Like I had truly surrendered. And I had that moment of just, whatever, I just need help. I am lost and I need help. I don't know what that help looks like, but I need help. I was taken away, and it was that moment when my mom got there right before the police officers took me. It was like, give your mom all your jewelry, take off everything. You know, you're a warden of the state. I was 10-13 that day. And I, after staying in the hospital with security guards watching me, you know, for a couple of days, because I was detoxing from being completely drunk, I was sent to decaf crisis. It was real in there, you know, like it was the realest experience, you know, and I don't want to say like, I mean, definitely you can look at Decaf Crisis and say this is a negative place and this is, it's scary. But on the other hand, it saved my life because it was so real. It was not a joke. The nurses were real. They were so honest with me, you know. No one sugarcoated anything. From the moment I walked in there and I got set up, she was like, "You're an alcoholic and addict." And I was like, "What? Like, no, I'm not. I have mental health. Like, let's not go there, you know." And she's like, "You're going to be doing these programs and that program and this and this." And I was just like, "Oh my gosh." But, you know, I had surrendered. So I was willing to do anything because I knew that I was miserable and something needed to change. And so that evening, you know, I ended up going to some AA meetings, and it was awesome. I got to meet some people who did R&I and came into Decaf Crisis, and that was beautiful. And I got to remember this book that I've been carrying around, and they opened the book that night, and it was so awesome. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is it. It has answers. And that was such a beautiful feeling. So Decaf Crisis, for me, it worked. I know for some people it doesn't work, but for me it worked because I knew that I never wanted to come back and be this low. This was my bottom. I never wanted to be this low ever again. And so so from that moment, you know, of course, they asked me that it was time for me to leave because I was making all of the clients laugh and we had too much fun. You know, you're not supposed to have fun in treatment, especially not at Decaf Crisis. Like, do not start a laughing circle at Decaf Crisis. The guards do not like that. So they were like, it's time for you to go. And so, you know, of course, they were like, here you go. Take your big book and hit to a meeting as soon as possible. And so I did, you know, and I immediately got a sponsor. And as I started working the steps with my sponsor, I realized that I had done the first step before I even got into this program, because that day when I attempted to commit suicide, I surrendered that day. I fell to my knees and I surrendered, and I truly knew that I was powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. My life was unmanageable. Things were not working. I was not a good mom. I was not a good friend. I was not a good wife. I was not a good anything. I was not a good person. Then the second step came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I wanted sanity so badly. Like, my life was such a spiral down different rabbit holes that the word sanity was the most peaceful thing I could ever hear. And so for that, absolutely I could believe in a power greater myself. I knew there was something bigger than me. I grew up in a Jewish family, and so religion was never really a thing. You know, we celebrate the high holy days and things like that. But, like, it was so strict and so traditional and so, like, just, like, in a box, you know? And so a power greater than myself, I could get down with that. My idea of a power greater than myself, a kind and loving power, an energy, a happiness, you know? I could get down with that. So then step three, I made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And so, you know, I had made that decision once again on that very first day, but then I was able to make that decision again and know in my heart that this was the direction I wanted to go in. God, you know, was the answer, a spiritual way. I had to get connected to the spirit of the universe. I did, because everything that I was doing wasn't working. Everything was repeating itself. And I used to think that my life repeated itself. Like, every 4 years, it would just repeat and repeat and repeat. And it would just be different people and different names and different places, but it was, like, still this repetition. And so I had to get out of that. And I was so grateful, you know. Like, I know a lot of people fear the fourth step, and there's a lot of, you know, talk about how scary it is. I was excited for the fourth step. I was excited to be able to write and put pen to paper and get all of this stuff that I've been thinking for so many years, all the way from, you know, age 13 when my dad passed away. I could put all of that on my fourth step. Fourth step is made to searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And so to be able to do that writing and to have a sponsor who walked through life with me and held my hand and taught me how to do all of this was beautiful. And so writing that inventory was like the most eye-opening and relieving experience I could ever go through, you know? And I always tell everyone, like, don't stop there, you know? Everyone wants to get to the fourth step and then fall off or just do 1, 2, and 3. But, like, the fourth step is where it's at, you guys. It's where you get to, like, just clean house, get rid of all that baggage, you know? And so I was able to do that, and I did a lot of writing, and then I got to admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. At first, when I sat down with my sponsor, like, that lying sense creeped in the background, that string that followed me. And I thought about lying about some things on my fourth step because I wasn't sure if my sponsor could handle some of the stories that I wanted to tell her, right? Like, I need to worry about that. But I finally was able to just start talking with her, and the things came out. And the fact that everything that I said, she was like, oh, I did that. Oh, that's fine. Oh, that's it? That's all I did? Like, I mean, it was so crazy to me. I'm like, no, but this is the most embarrassing thing ever, and I have to take it to the grave. And she's like, just tell me. Oh, that's it? I did that too, girl? Like, what? Like, get out of here. Like, I was so, it was like mind-blowing. And so, you know, that was such a relief. And to anyone who is working on their fourth step right now, like, no, that's the great thing about everyone in this room. We've all experienced it. And it's not like you're telling someone who doesn't understand the story or doesn't understand the struggle or doesn't understand where it came from. And that is so beautiful. I got to write that fourth step and it was beautiful. And I have done many fourth steps in my time here. I know some people say, man, you can do just one and keep it pushing. But I feel like every year fourth step needs to be done at some point just to clean up what happened in the past year or what's going to happen in the future or things like that. Just so I can always have a clean slate. And I want you to know that, like, just because I'm in sobriety and just because I have time doesn't mean that I live perfectly or that I have done this well, you know? It's a learning experience. It truly is. I have infidelity in my story. In sobriety, I have the power to choose. I have the power to choose right or wrong. And I chose to do the wrong thing because it fills my head up like an obsession. And I couldn't stop obsessing about it. And so I continued to do the wrong things. I've cheated on people in sobriety. I've stolen things in sobriety. I have done really bad things. I've hurt people in sobriety. And I thought just because I cleaned up everything that I was doing before and everything that I could blame on drugs and alcohol for being the reason why I did these things, I still continued to do bad things. You know, but the great thing about this program is that my sponsor continues to love me with open arms. And no matter what, she's always willing to unpack no matter what choice I make. And that's the beautiful thing about a sponsor, is that they guide you and then they let you make the choice. And whatever that choice is, good or bad, whatever you, when you pray about it, you talk to your network, and you get enough advice and do whatever you do, she's like, whatever it is at night, just let me know. You know, whatever you choose, my sponsor allows me to unpack it if I chose the wrong thing. And that is so beautiful. Not once has she ever told me, I told you so. Not once has she ever said, well, you know, you got yourself into this, dig your way out. No, she walks with me and we dig ourselves out together. And that's what's so beautiful about this program. And it hurts my soul to think of the things that I'm capable of doing when I am sober. And because I thought that I only did horrible things when I was under the influence. And that just wasn't the case. And that's how I know that drugs and alcohol, and that's why it's not mentioned that often in this book, it was a solution. It's what numbed me. It's what made me feel better for the horrible things that I was doing. That's what solved the problem for me. But the thing is the person that I am in sobriety and the bad choices that I make or the good choices that I do make, like, that's who I am. That's the choice that I get to do, you know? And so today I choose to do the next right thing. And that's why they say that. I have to choose every day to do the next right thing. And it's amazing because step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I have every defect of character. Like, my sponsor just was like, 12 and 12, 7 deadly sins, you have all of them. Okay, here you go. And I was like, awesome. Like, I was more so identifying with this 7 wonderful heavenly sins, you know, not sins, the wonderful side over there. But she was like, nope, you have all of the sins. And so, you know, I was like, my gosh, I got a lot to work on. But, you know, like, every single day I have to wake up and ask my higher power to remove these character defects. And every morning, I have to wake up and ask God to remove all seven deadly sins because I'm probably going to use them today. But the great part is that if I do slip up and use them, tomorrow's a new day, and I get to try again tomorrow. And that's the beautiful thing about this program. And so, step seven, we come to humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I am willing to do anything in this program. I truly am. I am absolutely willing. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's on God's time or that's, you know, when I live God's will. It doesn't. Being willing is being open-minded and ready to take action. But I feel like I have sponsees who tell me all the time that they're too afraid to take the action. So it's like they strike themselves out immediately. But we have to be willing and we have to be ready. And, you know, my sponsor always says, suit up, you know, be ready, have your book. Don't ever come to a war without weapons, you know. And this book is my weapon. It is my guide. It is my treasure map. You know, I did become willing to make amends to anyone that I did harm. But I have to understand that those amends may harm that person if I make them. So I have to, you know, get in touch with my sponsor and really be on top of that. Step nine, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So once again, you don't want to hurt anyone with your amends just to make ourselves feel better. I've written many letters that I've burned and things like that just because I don't want to bring more harm to the situation. I don't want to harm more people. My job is to clear my side of the street. I'm also a big fan of living amends. I vow to never live like that again. I have learned my lesson with the person that I harmed. It will cause more harm for me to contact them and make an amends to them. But my action steps are that I won't repeat those actions ever again. So for me, infidelity and sobriety, I will never repeat those actions again because I understand how harmful they are. I understand how hurtful it is. I understand that it's not the human being that I want to be. It's not. Like, I want to live at the highest level. I want to do the right thing. My sponsor asks me all the time, you get to choose. God is everything or God is nothing. Which do you choose? And I choose that God is everything. And with that comes with following that lifestyle. Sobriety is a lifestyle. And it is not a fad. It is actions that are truly changed. And that is beautiful, you know? And so then we get to step 10, and we continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, we promptly admitted it. So these are like mini four steps all the time, you know? And I love that, because it's simple questions, like, do you owe anyone an apology? Did you lie to anyone today? Are you mad at somebody? You know, anything you need to talk to your sponsor about? Literally, like, the questions are so awesome. It's just like, yes, no. Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes I'm like, no, I don't owe you an apology. As I, like, cussed you out earlier in the day. And I'm like, no, we're good. We're good. Everything is good, you know? And so I try to be as honest as I possibly can. But I show my sponsor, and that's when the questions come out. And she asks me, you know, hey, like, I noticed that you were angry at this person, but you're saying that you don't owe them an apology. Like, what's the deal with that, you know? And so we talk it out. But that 10th step, really, it is nice to be able to review your day each day. It is nice to be able to go through and see if you are actually attempting to live as a good person and to do the next right thing and to have these questions to follow and keep you on track, which is beautiful. And then 11, my all-time favorite step in the entire set, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. I stay in prayer and meditation. That is where I stay. I pray twice a day. I thank God for everything. I thank God for the lessons. I thank God for the future. I just thank God for just waking up today, because I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not. You know, for the amount of times that I've attempted to commit suicide and the things that I've done and the amount of alcohol I've consumed and the alcohol poisoning that I've had and the things that have happened to me and the bad experiences and the blackouts, I'm not supposed to be here. But I am. So that means I have a purpose. Just like everyone in this room has a purpose. We're all here for a reason. Every single person has a purpose. And I had a sponsor tell me once, if you really want to go that badly, figure out your purpose, get it done, and God will let you go. But I didn't know my purpose, and I just recently started to figure it out. And the funny part is that when I found my purpose and I figured it out, I don't want to go anymore. Like, I want to stay. Like, I like it here. I love helping people. I love having a network. I love being in sobriety. Like, this is where I want to be. And that's where you have to get to. And then step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And so that's what I attempt to do every day. Practice these principles in all of my affairs. I work with other women, which is awesome. The sponsorship that we have is beautiful. I thank so much for every sponsee that I've ever had. They've been brought to me literally through God. I've never seen such a thing. If you want to see God work, just get a sponsee, you know? And the people that they put in your life and the things that you walk through with them and the journey, it's beautiful. I have a sponsee who I walked through, the biggest thing I've ever walked through in my 8 years last year. She hurt somebody and had to go to prison. And though this program changed her, it didn't change the law or the consequences that we have to go through for what we did. Our actions have consequences. And so though we worked the steps and she was free and she was a changed woman and I saw God light up in her, the judge still said, you have to serve your time. And that was the hardest thing for me because in that moment I thought to myself, is God really that cruel? Like, what? Like we changed. We did this work. We followed this book. But then I had to realize that there is a bigger plan. We didn't know who she was going to affect inside those walls. We didn't know who she was going to touch. We didn't know about the AA and the sobriety and all the things that she would bring inside the walls of prison. She did so much, so much. She was a light inside of there for people who needed a light because she was free and she already did all the work. And she walked through it so strong and she held her head up high. I got to watch her walk in. I had the joy of watching her walk out. And that was beautiful. And it was such an honor to be on that journey with her. And that's why I say when you get that sponsorship relationship, you walk through life. And I'm talking, we walk through life. So if you have a sponsor that you feel like you can't walk through life with, get a new sponsor. Because I am telling you right now, my sponsor is ride or die. Okay? She tells me all the time, well, I know where all the dead bodies are. You know, I'm not talking about it. I know where all the dead bodies are, right? I know where all the dead bodies are. But I'm saying, like, if you can't walk through life with your sponsor, you got to get a new one because your sponsor is the one thing that it holds your hand, gives you that strength. You guys do life together, and that is so beautiful. And what was so freely given to me, I want to so freely give back to others. And that's what's beautiful about this program is that we all continue to so freely give back and give to others. I have also taken my giving to others to the next level. I was blessed enough to get with some partners to open up a women's sober living. And I felt like that was the next level that I needed to take my giving, what was so freely given to me, and give back to others because I realized that especially in the state of Georgia, women resources are very low. Men have everywhere to go, but women have nowhere to go. And then the next thing I know, they shut down another women's resource. It's like that's what we shut down all the time. And so I just couldn't handle that. I walked through with so many sponsees who've been in sober living. I didn't like where they lived. I didn't like the things they had to deal with. I didn't like so much I didn't like. And so I decided to open my own program. And it's been awesome. And it's been such a learning experience. It's been a joy to walk through life in a different way with women. Because in sober living, we walk through life 365, 24/7. Like, we walk through life on a daily basis. More so than my sponsees. My sponsees might not call me for 4 days, you know. But these girls, I see every single day. And we walk through life. And it's so beautiful to see how these lives have grown and they've changed and how this program changes people and the things that it does for people and the things that it brings. It's so awesome. It is so awesome, you guys. This program it makes me speechless because there are so many opportunities and it brings out such a light in each and every one of us. And I just don't know where I would be if I didn't have this book. Like, I tell people now, I'm grateful to be an alcoholic because I was so lost in life and there was nothing. Religion didn't give me anything. Like, it was like, all right, just follow these rules just because, you know? And I had mentors, but they couldn't really guide me. They didn't get me, you know? Like, in this program, in this book, this is the roadmap. This is how to be successful right here. It changes every time you read it. It truly does. The answers are right here. Bill Wilson is a phenomenal, you know, person who literally had the God of Light just drop on his head and he wrote this book, you know? And it's so beautiful. And I'm so grateful for that because if he didn't, I would seriously be lost, you know? Like, I'm glad that I get to identify with a group of people. And I know that a lot of people think, oh, it's a taboo, or my family is like, are you really an alcoholic at this point at 8 years? You can't have a drink with us? And I'm like, no! Like the allergy will wake up and I will burn this shit to the ground! Like, we can't do that, you know? And so, but with that, I love this program. I'm going to read something out of the back of the book that I love, and then I'm going to let you guys have this meeting back. I appreciate all of you having me here tonight. But on my favorite, it is one of my favorite stories in the back of the book, Acceptance Was the Answer is the chapter. And acceptance is the key of my relationship with God today. I never just sit and do nothing while waiting for him to tell me what to do. Rather, I do whatever is in front of me to be done, and I leave the results up to him. However it turns out, that's God's will for me. I must keep my magic magnifying mind on my acceptance and off my expectations. For my serenity is directly proportional to my level of acceptance. When I remember this, I can see I've never had it so good. And thank God for AA. And I thank you all, guys.
Thank you. All right. Awesome. Can I have a volunteer to give up to?
Yes,
you got a chance to mark a time of sobriety. If you're confident in coming back, I've got a white chip for you today. Come on.
Yes, sir!
You got a silver chip for 30 days.
I got 30 days.
Come on. Let's keep it going. 60 days. Go 90 days. Woo! 6 months. 6 months. 6 days. Come on. I'll give it a second, Roll. Just get you on. 6 months. Dead. 9 months.
Keep coming.
Blues, fears, and multiples.
My name's Kirk. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Kirk.
This is 22. Anything shows that the program to work is the fact that I got 22. I go to meetings. I have a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor for 20 years. He knows me. I know him. He calls me on my shit every day. And I work the sets. So thank you so much for your story. I resonated with so much of what you said. My story is different, but it's the same. Yeah. And that's the thing about hearing somebody tell their story, is no matter who it is that you hear, that you can reach out and touch. And I appreciate it. So thanks.
Any other years or multiples?
Daniel.
I got 4 years. I'm just grateful to be here. AA is alive and well in Atlanta. Thank you.
My name's Annie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey!
This is sick. Woo! Really good to be in a room full of degenerates just like thank you so much. I moved here last year from Los Angeles, and it's been like really a year of a lot of starting over, you know, in a new city, a new fellowship, a new sponsor. So like, I have burned my life to the ground before I got to AA, and like, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a whole new life, and then we came here, and like, honestly, I would have nothing if it wasn't for this program yet again, and starting over has just been a reminder of that. Like, I have new friends here. You know, I would have like literally nothing without this program, and my LA family came out for my birthday, and then I got an LA speaker. Thank you guys so much.
I'll offer the watch for the second time. We will. Just in case you're too high or too shy the first time. You have a proud sponsor of Chipsy Hole.
Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Something to take the edge, you see.